Hey everybody, this is Connor, your podcast producer. Welcome back to the Yellowbird Connect podcast, a special edition for you this week. Just as with some of our previous events, if you were not able to attend our Yellowbird Connect event on August 8th, we are bringing you a replay of the main event from that Connect. This is the keynote from Lee Kearney entitled Confessions of a Nine-Figure House Flipper. Lee was just on the Yellowbird Connect podcast as well, and he's sharing all of his knowledge and experience from his many, many years in the business. In addition to the keynote, Lee also stuck around for a little while at the end to do some Q&A with some folks that were in attendance. Anywhere where their questions were not picked up by the microphones, I'm just going to hop in and let you know what they said so that you can get the full experience. Anyway, hope you enjoy this little replay of Connect. We hope to see you at the next Connect, which is on September 5th, and hope you have a great week.
The main reason we started Connect is to give everyone the opportunity to do what I did.
We wanted to be able to offer the real estate community, especially locally, something new, something that was fresh.
And if we can help a couple people change their lives through this education.
Just one person or two people coming up to me saying, man, that was awesome. Like what you put on was great.
Then it'd be a huge win for everyone. If you've gotten any value at all from this Yellowbird podcast, make sure to like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes.
People that I can sit up and talk to. He's a real operator. He's different than, you know, a guru guy out there, a hedge fund guy, but he does the volume of those guys. So he's a real operator. We speak the same language. He's done massive amounts of business in all aspects of it. So not just, you know, wholesaling or retailing, or he's done the hedge fund models, he's owned rental properties. So crazy wealth of knowledge in the room. I'm pumped up that he's here tonight, and I'd like to welcome Lee.
All right. Good evening, everybody. It's good to be here in Jacksonville. I've flipped a lot of houses up here in Jacksonville. In fact, yes, sir, Obi. I've actually flipped a bunch of houses with Obi back there and done deals with a couple other people here in the room. And it's been a fun journey. Jacksonville has taken a huge appreciation over the last couple of years, if you've noticed. And part of what I'll be talking about tonight is that there's not blue skies forever, shockingly enough. So anyone who follows me on social media, I've been posting some articles really showing what's going on in the market, and I had a couple people kick back and argue, which is fine. I like good dialogue. I don't feel like I'm ever going to win an argument on Facebook, so I just put the information out there and see what happens. But one thing that is definitely apparent, when you look at the short-term risk that investors see, there's a sense in the market that there's a lot of short-term risk. That's why you're seeing 10-year rates at astronomically low prices, because people are moving to much safer asset classes. They're getting scared of the market. They're getting scared of the short-term risk, and that's why you're seeing the inverse yield curve and all this crazy stuff happen, which is normally warning signs of a bad economy. Now, the good news is real estate is not necessarily the exact same as the economy, but a lot of this does work together. You've got principles like the short-term debt cycle, where at the beginning of that, people are borrowing a bunch of money. So what happens? You're basically spending more than you earn, right? At the end of that cycle, what happens, people start paying it back, defaults kick in, and that could be everything from a car loan to a house. And so you start to see that the chickens come home to roost, and ultimately, you can't just keep borrowing more money than you earn. You've got to start paying this back. Now, we live in a world of credit. There's probably about three times the amount of credit in the world than there is cash. But the way the world economy works, it's all considered the same as cash. So we're, even as a world economy, we're highly leveraged. Now, I will tell you, one of my mentors told me a long time ago, he said, leverage is the key to wealth. So for anyone out there, if you want to be truly wealthy in real estate and not just flipping houses, trading your time for money, leverage is the key to wealth. But you got to be responsible. You can't just borrow. Just because the banks are willing to give you money, I would argue it doesn't make sense always to borrow it. Banks are crazy right now. There's a lot of money in the market. There's a huge surplus of cash. They're trying to deploy capital. Just because they'll lend it to you doesn't mean you should borrow. So as I was putting together tonight's presentation, I was really thinking about some of the questions that I get asked over and over again. And I've done a lot of deals. I mean, over $500 million, 7,500 plus transactions. I mean, the number's growing. That's an old number. At this point, it's just a lot. In fact, I look back at my history of one of my lenders. From one individual private lender, I borrowed almost $110 million from one lender over the years. And so, you know, it's been quite a journey. I've learned everything in real estate, every single lesson. I've bought and sold properties. I've done the turnkey model. I worked as an operator for a hedge fund for a a couple years. I've bought notes, I've sold notes, I've foreclosed on people. I've been on every side of every transaction. So I've really seen the full gamut. I've been a lender, I'm still a borrower, I'm still a lender. So I've done both sides of those transactions. And real estate's amazing. The cool part about real estate is that there's so many vehicles to make money. And one thing I'll tell you guys that I've learned, real estate's just a vehicle to get you from A to B. Now, the good news is there's plenty of other vehicles in this world, so I don't subscribe to the fact that real estate is the only thing that you can make money. But if you just stuck with real estate, there's probably 5-10 different ways you can make money just in real estate. Now, I've diversified at this point, but all of that money that I've diversified into other industries has all come from real estate. So I credit real estate with my success. I credit just doing a lot of deals, listening to a lot of smart people, reading a lot of books, and actually not as many books as I've listened to smart people. The mentors in my life have a net worth in excess of $100 million. It's the only people I listen to. And they've really, really taught me a lot of valuable lessons about money, about leverage, about markets, about the economy. And all these things kick in. If you really want to nail this game, you can flip houses. But if you want to become truly wealthy, at some point, here's the cycle for investors. You trade your time for money, so you make money, you create an income. Then at that point, you want to invest it, hopefully, into a passive vehicle. Now, a lot of people mistake the fact that they've got a rental as it being a passive income. The vehicle is passive, but if you're actively talking to tenants and contractors every day, I would argue that's not a passive vehicle. Or sorry, it's not a passive business. The same thing for flipping. If you get really good at flipping, you can put all the people in places, and even though the business is active, that can actually be a passive vehicle for you because you're stepped out of the business. And at this point, with the amount of different things that I'm focused on right now, medical marijuana, big, big passion of mine, big focus of mine, real estate education. So those are the things that are really, to me, I'm passionate about. Real estate is just a vehicle to make money. So I put the right people in the right places to essentially run that business for me. So as we talk about the journey of a real estate investor, so you start off trading your time for money. Ultimately, you want to pull yourself out of the business and turn it into a passive vehicle. And then the third challenge, which a lot of people don't think about, is how do you keep the government away from it, which is really, you know, minimizing your tax exposure. So I would just encourage you guys, you know, whether you've done one deal or no deals or 100 deals or thousands of deals, you know, you got to focus on all three things. Ultimately, you don't want to be flipping houses for the rest of your life. You want to think about what's next, what am I investing that money into? I've seen a lot of people spend all this time on flipping houses, on spreadsheets and analytics, and then they just buy any old rental and they're like, oh, it's just a rental, and they don't care about it. You can make millions of dollars, you can lose millions of dollars from rental. Ask Kyle. I mean, with a rental portfolio like that, if you, incremental changes in a portfolio like he holds right now, massive differences, just in 1 year. And so you take that over 5 or 10 years, you're talking millions of dollars swing one way or the other. So it's important, even with your income that you've created from real estate, to make sure that you roll it into a passive vehicle that makes sense, that runs without you, and then ultimately you need to focus on tax. So I've surrounded myself with mentors that have really nailed how to minimize tax. In fact, one of my mentors picked up and left and moved to Puerto Rico. He was just so tired of paying California tax. Seems extreme, but if you looked at his P&L and his balance sheet, it swung $5-7 million a year, a difference in tax liability. It's just insane. So just really strongly encourage you guys to think about where you're going with this business and not be so focused on what you're doing today that you wake up 10 years from now and you're still a flipper. And you're just still trading your time for money, and you're still trying to do everything yourself, and you've got nothing to show for it. So really, you think that that can happen. I could point out multiple people that I know personally that are making $1 million plus or minus and have nothing to show for it in real estate. So anyway, let's jump into tonight's presentation. So lessons learned, confessions of a nine-figure house flipper. That's my glamour shot. They made me look really good there. Lessons learned from buying and selling over $500,000. So Spin is my company. I'm the founder, started that company, actually rebranded about 6 years ago. We were West Florida Wholesale Properties. Then I started buying all over Florida. So we changed to Spin, Southeast Property Investments Network. Now we're buying nationwide, but I didn't want to change the name again. And Spin's cool. We can do lots of fun stuff with the logo. So we kept with Spin. I've been a real estate investor since 2004, actively buying all over the nation, so over 7,500 transactions, over $500 million, and one of the largest buyers privately owned in the country. So big car guy, big into my son, mean, that's the two things that, you know, big passions of mine. Got into boxing lately too. So I was talking with Kyle, he was talking about, you know, breakfast with Kyle. I was trying to think of a cool phrase where I could do boxing with Lee in the morning and see how many people want to come boxing. So might be a good way to get out your aggression and network. But I'm not sure if that would be a fail or win or a liability, but we'll see. I'm still rolling around that idea. So that's just a little bit about me. So 2004, 2005, 2006, and 2007 and 8. Why am I talking about this? How many people here are pre-bubble? Okay. So how many people know where I'm going with this? Yeah. I'm going to talk to all the pre-bubble people who experienced this firsthand. I'm going to talk to all the people who didn't and think blue skies and real estate's going to go up forever and Jacksonville is going to be 15% appreciation for the next 10 years. So I'm going to talk to all of you. So 2004, did my first flip in California. And what was interesting about that is I found a coach, a guy I went to church with, and he was a flipper. So I followed him around, went to Home Depot, helped him load up materials. And I will tell you this, don't go starting to ask people when you're new in the game, hey, can I take you out for lunch and pick your brain? I mean, that's like the worst thing. If someone talks about picking my brain, I want to run away. So I just am not interested. One guy actually offered, I think it was bourbon or something at some really classy bar. I'm like, well, that's a little bit more interesting. But I thought that was cool. I was like, I might let you pick my brain there. That would be more interesting. But my point is, try to provide value, figure out what you can do. I think Kyle and I had a conversation. I may butcher this a little bit. Hook yourself up with an operator. Go work with them for a year or two, even if it's for free. People pay $100,000, $200,000, depending on what profession, for college. And you've got investors in this town that have done deals you can only dream of. Go provide value. Say, hey, listen, what can I do? How can I help you out? How can I work for you? Maybe you can sell stuff and make commission. Then it's a win-win. But my point to all that is try to find someone who's doing this business. Don't try to do it alone. And you'll see why in just a second. So as I progressed through 2004, I started doing a couple deals in California, made money, moved back to Florida, asked all the same questions. I will tell you this, there's no dumb question when you don't know. I showed up at a foreclosure auction. You know what they were selling? Numbers. I had no idea what they were selling. They were selling numbers. Literally, there was an auctioneer auctioning off numbers. And then people were bidding on these numbers, and they were bidding in $100 increments, and they were buying these numbers, and then they were bringing up cashier's checks and sometimes bags of cash. By the way, I'm not sure if it's still like that up here in Jacksonville, but in Hillsborough County, you could literally bring up cash. Now, I remember there's this one guy from Miami. I think he ran a laundromat or something like that, but anyway. He would literally show up and buy every property. We went through this literally for a couple months. He bought every property every day for about 2 months, and it was always cash, like a big bag of cash. So that was interesting. But my point to that is they were auctioning off numbers. So I started to ask questions. I said, what are these numbers? They were case numbers. Asked more questions. Found out there's a lady that provided a book that turned the numbers into addresses. Cool. Now I'm off to the races, right? So I started driving the properties in the morning and then go to the auction in the afternoon. Now, when I first showed up, it was a bunch of used car salesmen and people were looking at each other and winking. Not, I didn't know what was going on. Finally figured out, okay, this person knows this person and, you know, they're trying to strike a deal and maybe do things that may or may not violate federal or state law, but nothing which I would be involved in. And so I became one of the biggest buyers at the Hillsborough County auction very, very quickly. Now, I'm thinking clear skies ahead, just like you guys are today in 2019. Nothing's going to rock my world. I'm, you know, 20-something years old. I think it was 27 when I lost everything, which we'll get to in just a moment. I guess I kind of blew the punchline there. So I was buying and selling. In fact, at the time, I had no money. So I racked up a bunch of credit cards, and I could go down and buy the house with credit cards, 3% cash advance, cheapest hard money loan in town, by the way, back then, 6 months interest-free. I had the house flipped before I even had to make a payment on the credit card. So I was getting cash advances and going down to the clerk with 100 grand and buying the house. Bank of America said, we like what you're doing. We'll give you 100 grand in every house as soon as you give a certificate of title. I'm like, this is amazing. Buy it with a credit card, cash out with a line of credit. This was all happening in 10 days. So I went from zero to millions of dollars of real estate literally overnight. Here's the problem, and this is my caution to everybody out there. I wasn't paying attention to the market. So I'm doing the same thing 2005, 2006. Beginning of 2007, I'm like, my houses aren't selling as fast. I didn't have any people in my life telling me what was going on in the real estate market. Then it got to the point, well, they're not selling at all. Now I'm lowering prices. I'm like, they're still not, I'm still buying, by the way. Complete moron. So I ended up buying into a downward market in 2007, By the end of 2007, I had made and lost $2 million. 27 years old. That was tough. I was 25 at the time. I get my age is confused. I don't like to think about my age now. As soon as I turn 40, it's just not cool anymore. So it's like the halfway point. You get all these depressing thoughts. But anyway, so lost everything. In fact, I didn't get out of bed for about 2 weeks. It was really tough. I'm like, what went wrong? It's like I was the richest guy in my group. Now I'm dirt poor. I don't have a pot to piss in. I have no money. My confidence is completely just like at zero. I mean, literally, I lost all confidence. Now, I say that to you because I want to make sure that I'm touching everybody here in this audience. You don't just see me here today. You see Lee 2007 and lost everything, literally everything. And I know a lot of people say that, professional speakers. I did. I can give you 20 people in my circle you can talk to where I had nothing. So that was tough. And I remember a meeting with one of my mentors at the time, and I said, what do I do? I said, I'm done. Like, I'm literally done. I've stopped making all these payments. I got all these short sales. Got all these creditors calling me. I can't make any payments. I bought rentals, by the way, that were not cash flowing. For some reason, I thought this was a good idea to rent something for $1,200 and I owed the bank $1,300. I mean, just moronic. I mean, just, I don't know where I thought I was going to get out of that $100 deficit. That's before repairs, by the way. Then the toilet breaks, it's like, I'll cash flow 6 years from now. I mean, it was just stupid, completely, completely stupid. I believe my reasoning at the time was I couldn't flip it, so I'll just keep it as a rental. And that goes back to my previous point. You got to buy the right house in the right area at the right price, rehab it correctly, and really put the same thought and effort into a rental that you do a flip. But I didn't, so I was just turning stuff into rentals just to get them off the books. Then I end up with an upside-down portfolio that I couldn't service a debt on because people, obviously, toilets start breaking, stuff need replumbing because I wasn't rehabbing it correctly, so I wasn't redoing the PVC lines. Instead, I just left this old galvanized, no pressure, tenants are complaining. I couldn't fix the houses, so literally lost everything. So I met with my mentor. I said, Bumper was his name. That was his nickname. I said, what do I do? And he goes, son, you got to sell your way out of it. I'm like, well, that wasn't the answer I was expecting. I was expecting, sorry, you're doing this. Or he basically just kicked my ass and said, what are you doing? Just get out and sell your way out of it. So what I did was I looked around, and I learned two really valuable lessons in 2007 / beginning of 2008. Number one, there's always money in real estate. Because I saw guys driving around in really nice cars, crushing the real estate game, and I'm sitting there scratching my head, dead broke. I'm like, what the hell is going on here? How am I broke? How's this guy like in an amazing Ferrari or Lamborghini, and I'm just broke? We're both doing the same business. That was where I learned the second lesson. Not only is there always money in real estate, you gotta be on the right side of the trade. And the right side of the trade in 2007, 2008, was to be a wholesaler. Why? Zero risk. You don't bear any of the market risk. Essentially, what you're doing as a wholesaler is you're shifting the market risk to your buyer. Does everybody get that concept? In fact, even if you take an owner financing strategy like today, what are you doing? You're shifting the risk to the seller because they're financing it. So if there's market risk and the crap hits the fan, guess what? The seller is the only one out, especially if you do not have a personal guarantee in that loan. So it was interesting. I bore all the risk of the market. So as soon as the market took a dive, I took a dive with it. So, and here is the inspirational part of all this story. At the beginning of between 2008 and 2009, my first year wholesaling, did $1 million, back on the bandwagon again. So, you know, if I can do it, you can do it too. And I really would just strongly encourage you, look at the market, see what the opportunity is, and then figure out how to capitalize on it. Don't be just doing a strategy that makes zero sense. Try to fight this multi-trillion-dollar market and then wake up one day and realize you've lost everything and say, well, what happened? Well, what happened was you didn't have your eyes open. You were so busy in your business that you weren't paying attention to what was going on around. There's a big difference between 5 deals a year to a stable, consistent real estate business that operates like clockwork. Big, big difference. Now, I recognize a lot of people in this room. In fact, let's do a quick survey. How many people have not flipped the house? Okay. So that's quite a few. How many people have flipped 10 or less houses? 10 or less. Okay, how many people have flipped between 10 and 100? Okay, and how many people have flipped over 100 houses? All right, so we got big difference here, big difference. And I will tell you, for the people who have done over 100 here, the people who are just kind of doing that 0 to 10, even the jump from 0 to 10 to 10 to 100 is huge because you got to start putting the right people in place. And the difference doing over 100, big, big difference. I mean, you're just into systems, processes, and people, which is about what we're about to talk about. So I'm going to talk about my biggest lessons learned. I'm going to talk about where the market is today, and I'm going to talk about what the opportunity is. Just real simple journey through real estate. Keep it casual. I want you guys all to learn some nuggets out of this. So being a CEO, I really had to analyze this several years ago after I started scaling up in 2008, going, what am I doing? And I realized my job as a CEO is to drive today's profit, plan for tomorrow's direction, and solve major problems. And I think a lot of us get caught in the weeds. We think we're the kingpin. We're just strategic direction and vision, and we lose track of, well, am I making money today? So some of us get so focused on making money today, we're not looking ahead in our business. And then some of us feel so good and superior in what we're doing in running the company that we just pawn off major problems. I would argue from my experience in this business, doing a ton of deals, that all three of these are your job as a CEO. If you really want to run a successful company, don't run away from big problems. So, biggest lessons learned. So I try to consolidate a lot of the questions I've got asked over the years and just address those. So I want to go through an exercise of what it takes to make $1 million. Essentially, $1 million is really, let's just say that's your goal. And I think that 20 mile march example was good, but what that started off with was a goal. The goal was to go to Maine. So this is your goal right here, $1 million. And I think the reason I use this, a lot of people say I want to make $1 million in real estate. But when you break that down, $1 million a month, about 80, 83,000 a month, which equates about 20 grand a week. So what you have to do is start with your goal first and then build your action plan into it. And even before you build an action plan, really break it down into smaller goals, because $1 million sounds like a really high amount to climb. But if I told you guys 83,000 a month, let's just say you're a flipper, right? And you're making 20, 30,000. If you flip three good deals a month, can anyone here flip three deals a month? How many hands? Three deals a month. Come on, guys, three deals a month. You can do three deals a month. You can make $1 million a year rehabbing and flipping houses. Let's just say you're a wholesaler. Do you think if you start engaging some of these strategies, you cold calling, really targeted lists, that you could do two deals a week? How many people think they can do two deals a week? And if you notice, I'm using the smaller numbers here. I'm not talking about the $1 million. You do two wholesale deals a week, you can make $1 million a year. Real estate is a fantastic vehicle. And I say that to inspire everybody that sometimes this lofty goal just seems so high, you're like, there's no way I can get there. But when you think about it in smaller goals, and then you break that down to an action plan, now your goal is, well, how do I get two deals a week? And when you start to answer that question, it's a lot less daunting going, how do I make $1 million? Now that can still be your goal, but you're breaking your goal down to micro goals and really breaking that down to action plans that can be accomplished. So I say that to inspire everybody out there. Everybody in this room can make $1 million a year in real estate. So lesson one, mindset. This is a question I get asked a lot. The biggest thinking shift from the first deal to the 100th deal to the 1,000th deal. I mean, it's just, you have to think big. I say this, I can't say this enough. Whatever limits you put on yourself, if you say I'm gonna flip 10 houses, there's a decent chance you're probably gonna do 7 or 8 houses. That's what the goal you set. Now, I had a mentor in my life, thank goodness, a multi-$100 million guy at this point, and due to non-disclosures, I can't tell you which restaurant chain, he just purchased a couple weeks ago a worldwide restaurant chain. Guy based out of Tampa, Florida, really smart guy, one of my personal friends, mentor. I mean, just super guy. And I remember what he was telling me. This is before 10X became cool and that whole movement, which is cool, by the way. It's definitely, you know, I subscribe to success and moving forward and just thinking big. But he said at the time, if you see an opportunity, put your foot to the pedal. If it doesn't matter if you can do 100 deals or 1,000 or 10,000, you exhaust that opportunity. And I've never forgotten that. And so when I found good opportunities, and even today in real estate, I exhaust that opportunity however big it is. Now we're gonna get into some other things about what you need if you wanna be able to exhaust every single opportunity and not leave deals behind. But I want you guys to think big. The bigger you think, the bigger you can grow. The smaller you think, the more you're limiting yourself. You're literally putting handcuffs on yourself. You're just limiting by what the limits you set in your mind are as big as your business can grow. If you have this big mindset, you've got you couple that with an action plan that makes sense, the sky's the limit. I mean, just to talk about one of your local guys here, I mean, are you able to talk about the size of your rental portfolio? How big's your rental portfolio? 1,100 houses. Approximate market value?
$120 million,
right here in this room, yeah. That's amazing. I would argue there's probably not a lot of people you can talk to and have a conversation with that have $120 million in single family homes. You got one right here in this room. I mean, that's a real blessing for you guys. I can't stress that enough. Overcoming failure. You're gonna have obstacles. I can tell you, man, when I think about my first few deals, I bought the wrong house at the auction back in 2005. You think it can't happen? They auction off basically folio numbers. They don't, or legal descriptions. And the legal description, they put an address in the book, which I didn't realize, you know, had no liability. And so I bought the address in the book, I go to the house, and it's not even the right house. It was the house next door. And the house next door was under about 4 feet of water. So that was the right house. So I thought this house was amazing that I bought. The actual house that I really bought was under 4 feet of water. This is back when I had no money, 2005. I'm just starting out. And I remember I bought the house, and the way it works at an auction, for those of you who bought, I'd put out the cash for that asset. I mean, I bought it. I mean, it was mine. They use a term, a caveat emptor, which is basically buyer beware, a Latin term. Man, I own the house. Now, I had two choices. I could have just said, you know what? I'm done, there's too much risk, stupid book, I'm gonna sue that lady, I'm done with this business, and just move on to something else. That's what I could have said. That was a very logical choice, by the way. When you put 50 grand into a house that was worth, I mean, I think the lot was worth 10 or 20. I mean, the house was garbage, it was just underwater. But instead I said, you know what? I gotta pay more attention and cross-reference the legal description against the address that's listed in the book, and check that against the appraiser site, and check that against the tax collector site, and make sure all three match up. I mean, how many people saw the story about the guy who bought this, I think it was like a 2 foot strip? Yeah, I mean, it's funny, but you know what? Buyer beware. You know, it's funny. I guess he thought he was buying a condo for 11 grand. I don't know, but for me, I've no sympathy. I've lost way more money than that at auction, so I was like, well, too bad, so sad. So you're not gonna get much sympathy here. But you have to have the mindset that there will be failures in your business. The key with failures is to learn from those. Learn quickly, change direction quickly. What's gonna tank your business is you fail, you don't change quick, you keep doing the same wrong thing, you're out of business. And just like Bumper told me, when all else fails, get up and sell more. So I really like that. So let's talk about scaling. Because a lot of people look at me and you see it in an office, you see systems, processes, and people. I'm gonna try to boil it down to the simplest level possible tonight. There's two main things that are gonna drive your business. Systems and processes are cool, but people is the other half of the assets in your company. There's so many people that forget how important their people are. Kyle, how important is your team? So if you didn't have a team tomorrow, where's your business?
10 years ago, I never thought that.
Right, but let's just suppose you have no team tomorrow. What happens to your business?
You're done.
There's no possible way you could manage 1,100 rentals with no team. Team is half of the assets that we build. And a lot of people just don't put time into that. So what I'm talking to you guys, whether you're a beginner, you've never done a deal, you're a small operator, you're a mid-level operator, the only way to scale is to have great systems and processes and have great people behind those systems and processes. I can't stress that enough. Hire rock stars, pay them well. Don't be ashamed about it. So let's talk about time. This is one of my key strengths at this point. I'm the CEO of two active corporations. I'm about to be the CEO of a third. You want to talk about busy? I can show you my calendar, my Google calendar. It's color-coded from 4:30 in the morning till sometimes late at night, but that's okay. I get stuff done. I get the stuff I want done. I even block out time for my son. Why? Because if I don't do that, if it's important to go to a meeting, it's important to spend time with my son, right? So I decided to block out time for my son just like I did for any other business meeting or any other activity I wanted to do. Your most valuable asset is your time. Ultimately, we're only on the earth for so many years, which equates to so many months, which equates to so many days, which equates to so many hours, which equates to so many minutes, which equates to so many seconds. So when you think about that, that is your most valuable asset, because that's the one that's diminishing every single day. Unless we're gonna live forever, I don't know if anyone's figured that out, cool, let me know afterwards. But for most of us, that asset's diminishing. So I really value my time. And I will tell you this, you've gotta proactively protect your time. If you're not proactively trying to protect your time, people will steal your time. And you hear a lot of people say, I heard it, and I used to say this myself, I'm like, man, that guy wasted my time or that lady wasted my time. No, you allowed them to waste your time. In fact, you allowed them to steal your time. Just like when something goes wrong in your business, all of us want to take credit when something goes well. I nailed that flip, I made 50 grand. If you lost money, it's the contractor's fault, right? It's the agent's fault. It's everybody's fault. It's with your project manager. It was the wholesaler that sold you that bad deal. They're the problem, right? No. When something goes wrong in your business, it's your fault. When you allow people to steal your time, that's your fault. We can fix these things. You don't have to be a jerk and just not answer your phone and just tell everyone to get lost. There's a tactful way to do that, but you do have to proactively be thinking about this. Planning is key. I cannot stress this enough. The reason my schedule runs well, the reason I make all my meetings, the reason all of my projects move forward, the reason all of my businesses move forward is because I plan. In fact, if I'm out of the office one day, I'm at least planning one day. If I'm out of the office for a week, it's a week of planning. So me and my assistant, we're sitting down, we're looking at everything that's a week out, making sure that we cover that so that the business doesn't skip a beat. You gotta surround yourself with the right people. I mean, this is where your team just really kicks in when you talk about leveraging your time. So if you're just starting out, your most important hire is what, Obi? Executive assistant. That is the most important. If you find yourself running around after your assistant, that's not a good thing. So the most important quality you want to look for, someone that's organized, more organized than you. There's nothing wrong with that. Ultimately, we want to hire people better than us, and we want to be able to remove ourselves from the business and have people that can handle stuff start to finish. So you got to surround yourself with the right people. It goes back to the previous slide. Leveraging technology and automation. I don't care if you're 20 or you're 60 or 70 or 80. It doesn't matter. You're gonna get left behind if you don't engage technology. Even me at 40, I'm having to learn Instagram, which I realize all the grandpas are on Facebook, and anyone who's cool is on Instagram. So I'm having to make the shift from grandpa land over to Instagram. So IG, Gram, Insta, whatever you wanna call it. But I've actually hired a team, because I'm so dumb on Instagram, that I've hired a team that's gonna be helping me with Instagram. So at the end of the day, I recognize this as a business owner. I've had to spend a lot of time developing softwares and things that work so I can automate things. This is the way forward. In fact, if you look at the market today compared to 15 years ago when I started out, I had a competitive advantage. I knew neighborhoods. I knew what was going on. You know that competitive advantage just goes out the window, right? With the amount of proliferation of technology, any one of us in here can comp the exact same house and come up with the exact same number. I mean, like really close. If you know what you're doing, I get 10 people in this room where we all know what we're doing, and it's a fairly standard house in a fairly standard neighborhood, I'd argue we'd probably be 5, maybe 10 grand off on our exit price, maybe, on a bad day. So technology is key to your business. Automation's key. But again, it goes back to my previous point. You gotta have the right people. Invest in your people. It's not an expense, it's an investment. You invest in your people. Right now, I've got a team that, on average, is about 7 years old. Amazing team. They can get a lot of stuff done. Invest in the right tools. You go to my office, you'll see everyone has got 4 screens, fast computers, fast internet. I mean, we got a lot done, a lot of productivity there. Now, I will tell you this is a real big problem for people. If you're focused on just firefighting today's problems, you're not building a business for tomorrow. You're just not. If you found yourself on this hamster wheel where at the end of the day, you know, people are calling you like, I can't, I'm fighting fires, it's emergencies. If every single day is an emergency in your business, you're the problem. You're the problem in your business. You've got to figure out how to take yourself out of the emergencies and take the emergencies out of your business. The only way to do that is to hire key people, or you might just be doing the wrong thing. It could be just a bad strategy you've got. But ultimately, you can't drive a business forward if you're constantly firefighting. That's not our job. That's why we have firefighters, not CEOs like us. So you got to make sure that you're not just firefighting every day. Lesson 4. Right people in the right role with the right direction, and hire rock stars. I've been saying this theme. If you've seen a theme here going on, this is a big lesson I've learned. People, people, people. It doesn't matter what business you're in. I look at the 3 businesses I'm in, between real estate, between the cannabis business, and between real estate education. It's all down to people. That's the X factor that makes those businesses unique and special. It's the relationships I've built. It's the people I work with. It's the people that work on my team. It's very rare you'll hear me call them employees. I feel like that's kind of demeaning, so I refer to them as my team. Why? Because we are a team. You know, we work together. I just have to have a different role than you. If you're on my team, then that's what I describe to people. I might be the captain. You might be the first mate, if you're using a ship example. But at the end of the day, we all have a different role in the same ship. We're trying to go the same direction. I would just encourage you guys to empower your team, to build up your team, and to recognize that that is the second biggest asset besides the intellectual property, your software, your cool technology that you think that you have that no one else has, which actually everyone else has. But it's true. People get these secret lists, and like, no, everybody else has that list too. So for those people who do lists, by the way, I'd recommend make your own list. And you can do that by taking these third-party lists or scraping the information yourself, putting some thought behind it, and trying to figure out where the needle in the haystack is and start calling, texting, or whatever other method you're using to contact those people rather than just trying to contact everybody. I found that to be a very expensive approach. And I would just encourage for any of you guys starting out with lists, just remember, if you can click a button and buy a list and download it, so can everybody else. So just keep that in mind. But people, people, people. You've got to hire rock stars. Don't be cheap with your people. Invest in your people. And don't settle. At the end of the day, we look for three things with people. I look for people who have the skill set. Number one, you got to have the skill set. So if you want to be my assistant, for instance, you got to be super organized. You got to be pleasant. That's great. You got to be motivated. What I've found over the years, if someone walks into my office like this, I normally just say, just go right back out. Because I already know before they sit down for the interview, it's just not going to work out. You can't make someone motivated. It doesn't matter whether it's someone on your team, someone in your family, one of your friends, your spouse. It doesn't matter. You can't change someone. You can encourage people, but you can't change people. So I try to look for the right base of a person that I want in my organization. And then I look for key things like that. So if they don't have the skill set, they're not motivated, they don't pass the test. Now I found plenty of skilled people, plenty of motivated people. Now I look at my team. If I feel like they won't get along with the rest of my team and fit in with our culture, we don't hire them, and neither should you. You want to make sure that you're building your team slowly, carefully, systematically, taking every hire really serious. By the way, if you don't want to spend a lot of time on this, you know, hire an amazing recruiter. That way they can do all the heavy lifting, just bring you in at showtime, and that's another way to leverage your time. But still doesn't change the point. People are key to your business. Understanding the market. This is huge. This is really goes back to my point from 10, 11 years ago. And even it's so valid today. A lot of people don't take the time to understand the market. So first of all, you just want to take a general look, like what's going on? So generally speaking, interest rates are low today, but prices are up and affordability is down. If I just created a general picture of what's going on in real estate, that's pretty accurate. But now you want to get into some fact finding. So you're really analyzing your market. Let's say we're talking about Jacksonville right now. Who's buying? Who's selling? You know, what kind of price points are they buying at? Where are investors buying? Why do you want to know this versus retail buyers? Depends what your strategy is. If you're wholesaling, you want to know where the cash buyers are buying. If you're retailing, you want to know where retail buyers are buying. So that it's important to understand what's going on in your market. And then wholesalers, you want to figure out where wholesalers are hanging out. That's a pretty good clue as to where the activity is. Now keep in mind, in 2019, rapid appreciation, let's just take Jacksonville, Tampa, pretty similar markets in a lot of ways. There's been rapid appreciation over the last few years, which means the risk-free strategy today is the wholesale. Why? You're putting the risk entirely on your buyer. Now I know there's plenty of people in this room, including myself, in Jacksonville, have made plenty of money on flips over the last couple of years, but ultimately the market starts to go down when it's doing really well. It doesn't say, hey, I'm about to take a huge dip, so just make sure you sell your last flip, and then I'm gonna tank. No, it just literally stops. And part of what fuels this, we're gonna talk about in a few moments, but there's a whole bunch of things happen. Investors stop buying, supply and demand tells you, demand gets cut off, everything else changes the same, price goes down. A lot of this is just economics 101. But it is important. This is the key point I want you to take away. Whatever market cycle you're getting into, you first of all want to understand the market. That's key. And it has to be in this order. Secondly, you got to figure out where the opportunity is, no matter what the market cycle is. Then you create your strategy. There's so many people who get into real estate with a strategy, and I'll give you the poster child of that. And if you disagree with me, just keep your comments to the end, or just don't mention them at all. But anyway, I think it's the wrong time. I'm kidding, by the way. You can say whatever you want. If I call on you, you can say whatever you want. But my point is, I don't think it's the right time to be building a rental portfolio today. Case in point, my average rental purchases were bought between 20 and 50,000. I've sold out 300 plus rentals in the last 18 to 24 months, on average between 150 and 180,000. So we go back to the lesson of being on the right side of the trade. If I'm the buyer at 150 to 180, am I on the right side of the trade or am I better as a seller? Now, obviously, tax implications and other things kick in, but for me, in Tampa, Florida, I don't want to be a buyer right now for rentals. I want to wait till prices settle down, make more sense, and I'm going to show you in a few moments why I think things are going to change. But it's very important, understand the market, find the opportunity, then look at your strategy. How am I doing time-wise, by the way, Yellowbird team? All right, cool. This is a tool I use. I'm not making any money off this, but just this is a tool I use. My point is I do data analytics before I go into new markets. I like this because I can drill down to individual zip codes. I can look at year to date. I can go back 2 years. I can see what's trending. And they use really simple colors. So if it's like, I think it's the red, the blue color is bad, then they've got another color if it's going up. But there's different colors to show whether the market's going up or going down. I don't want to flip into a downward market because I already did that and end up with being broke. So my point to all this, whether you use housing alerts or any other kind of data analytics, it's important to understand your numbers. For me, I check in about once a month on these kind of numbers. I don't look at this stuff every day. Why? The real estate market's not like the stock market. Stock market crashes in one day. Does real estate crash in one day? No. It typically moves in quarters, and you'll see a trend happen in the market. If you take an extreme example like California, the California market on average dropped about 60% over 30-something months. So if you boil that down per month, that was about 2% per month. So we're not talking like earth-shattering news in real estate in one day is going to tank a market. You may have a rise in interest rate, a drop in interest rate, but that doesn't equate to a 20% difference in prices overnight. So that is the good news about real estate. How to implement a strategy. So we talked a little bit about this, but you really want to understand, if you want to get from not doing a deal, you've got to understand these basic concepts. Where you buy from, that's your supply. It's just very simple. This is just like every other business, by the way. It just, our widget happens to be houses. Who are you going to sell it to? You got to figure these things out before you just start getting busy. A lot of people are busy, but they're not busy being effective. Really simple book, by the way. It's Who Moved My Cheese. I liked it, and I had my whole team read it a couple years ago. The reason I like it is because it just talks about really simple things, and you would think that we would know this stuff by now. But it talks about like these two guys just being busy. They're like, well, this isn't working, so I'm just going to work harder. And so many of us do that in our business. We just start working harder, especially starting out. You know, I see people bragging on Facebook and Instagram. They're grinding, they're hustling all night. I'm like, well, why? You don't have to do that. Just because you're busy doesn't mean you're busy making money. Just because you're busy doesn't mean you're being effective. So I always try to question the effectiveness. And that's why I'm starting out with some really simple principles. You got to figure out where you're buying from. That's your supply. I'll tell you another secret. Don't have one source. Have multiple sources. That provides stability to your business. Who are you going to sell to? You mentioned this earlier, Henry. Multiple exits. That's a good feeling, right? Because you're like, I can keep it as a rental. I can wholesale it to a cash buyer. I can sell it to a retail buyer because I fixed it up so it'll get financing on it. Multiple exits. A lot of that's down to your purchase price. Now, what you do with the property can also affect your exit. But ultimately, if you buy something cheap enough, you've got multiple exit. Let's just take a really simple example. If you buy below wholesale, what can you do with it? You can wholesale it, or you can retail it, or you can own or finance. You've got lots of different things. If you buy right at wholesale, there's no wholesale margin. Your only exit is to add value and keep it as a rental or retail it. So this is why purchase price is so important. You want to figure out who's buying. Now, you also want to look at the highest profit activity. You know, I've taught in many years past about the 2-to-1 rule, and now I'm, with today's market, I'm looking at three things. I'm looking at the amount of money, the amount of brain damage, and the amount of risk. I look at that on every single deal. So for me personally, for rehabbing houses out of state, one of the big brain damage eliminators, we only rehab houses 2000 or newer. All the old stuff, everybody else can have it. We're going to rehab 2000 or newer. In fact, my next rental portfolio, I'm only buying houses 2000 or newer. That's it. Now, we're to go statewide, which means we'll be able to compete. But next market cycle, we plan on buying 2,000 or newer statewide. That's what I'm going to be buying. So I'm looking at the highest profit activity. And my point of this is you really analyze wholesale versus retail. And this is an age-old argument. You have 20 people, you hear 20 different opinions. In today's market, if there's a wholesale arbitrage, you should really look hard at that. Because the amount of hours you spend, would it be unreasonable to say how many rehabbers we got here? Would it be unreasonable to say you spend 80 hours in a rehab? Would that be unreasonable for your personal time? Probably not. You know, I've done a lot of rehabs, and when I calculated my hours, it was astronomical at the beginning before I had a team. Now I spend no more time in a rehab than a wholesale. But back then, I was spending a lot of time. So if you take 10 grand now or 20 grand after retailing it, I mean, think about a wholesale deal. If you've got the right wholesale deal, typically start to finish a couple hours. Maybe on a bad day, 5 or 10 hours driving to the title company, collecting your check or signing your docs or whatever you want to do that not a good use of your time. By the way, have the title company come to you, have them wire your funds. You know, checks are cool, but I don't know why people get them anymore. But anyway, try to leverage your time. So I look at the highest profit activity, and what you're going to find is when you analyze the opportunity cost of that 78 hours, let's just say you spend 2 hours wholesaling for 10, what could you do? How many more 10 grand deals could you bring in if you spent 2 solid weeks just looking for wholesale deals rather than spending that time retailing? I encourage you to look at that amount of time you're spending retailing and make sure if your personal time is just astronomical, there's an opportunity cost for not chasing other deals. So that's very, very important. And the big focus in our business has to be acquisitions. That's where we make our money. I would argue, and people may disagree with me, and that's okay, everything after acquisitions is a process. There's a little bit of an art and a little bit of a science, but if you bring in garbage into your company at the wrong price, you're screwed day one. It's dead on arrival. If you bring in great inventory, you can screw up through your processes and still make money. So the most important thing in your company is always acquisitions. We talked about this earlier. They've got to have the right funding. A lot of people say, well, I don't have access to millions of dollars. You're literally tripping over money in today's market, by the way. And I would just really argue, although I didn't put this earlier about the job of a CEO, I'm going to mention it right now. Anyone who wants to create long-term wealth in real estate, part of your job should be raising capital. How many people here focus on raising capital? That's good. That's great to hear. For those of you who aspire to be big real estate investors, have a great profitable company, have longevity, create long-term wealth, you have to focus on raising capital. The capital here today, we just had this conversation, probably not going to be around when the market. As soon as the market doesn't make sense, the big lenders today will be running for the hills because they can't securitize your mortgage. Their game plan's over. It's like, oh man, we got to move on to the next hustle. So it's just a much bigger hustle on Wall Street, by the way, than what we're doing, but still a hustle. So just keep that in mind. But you've got to make sure that you've got multiple forms of financing. That you got to have the need for private and traditional financing, and your financing has to match your exit. So I wanted to talk about those two things. Why do you need private money? Seller X says, I need to close tomorrow. Or seller X's property is going to sale tomorrow afternoon. Is institutional money going to work? No. I need to be able to call my guy, my girl, and say, wire me $100,000 right now. There is a place for private money. Now, conversely, if most private money lenders don't want to be into a deal for 10 years, the big mistake the banks made back at the last mortgage meltdown was they were borrowing short and they were lending long. So they're handing out 30-year mortgages on floating rates themselves. So they just got completely killed. Borrow short, lend long. What I'm saying to all of you guys out there, make sure you're not borrowing short and holding long. If you want to have a rental property, for most people in this room, you're going to have to two-step it. What do I mean by that? You take down the asset, typically with private financing. You get it stabilized. You get it rehabbed. Put a tenant in it. And then there's dozens of lenders that will lend you, 70-75% today? I'm not currently buying rentals, but I'd say about 70-75% depending on your debt coverage service ratio. And if you buy right, you can get all your cash back out. But for most of us here in this room, you've either got to use your cash or private cash if you're building a rental portfolio and two-step that process, and then either get each individual asset individually collateralized or give them a bunch of assets and then get that pool collateralized with long-term debt. And long-term debt, what are rates these days on rentals about now?
Mid-fours.
I mean, it's insane. I mean, if you're buying right at all, even today, even though I'm telling you the sky is going to fall in just a moment, you can still cash flow on rentals if you buy them right. But you do want to focus on consistently raising money. And the more you build up your track record, the better your rates are going to be. I have a personal friend, $200 million line with Deutsche Bank. At the time, it was 25 basis points over LIBOR. But now it's obviously the LIBOR rate's gone up. But just, you know, credit really is the key to wealth. And as you climb the ladder, you'll get more attractive financing and just makes your job easier. Ultimately, for everybody in this room, Success for you is when a deal hits your table, you can close on it. Doesn't matter if it's tomorrow, next week, a month from now, 100 deals come tomorrow, 1,000 deals, you can close in every deal. And that's, if you want to start thinking big, start raising capital. That way you can take down every deal that comes your way. Obviously you want to get the right kind of capital. I would argue with today's margins, you get 15% and 5 points, which was my first hard money loan, by the way, 15% and 5 points. I needed the money literally in hours. I called the guy at 4:30 and I needed to fund a property because Bank of America didn't give me my line of credit. It was delayed by a day. So I bought a new property that morning thinking I was going to get my 100 grand that afternoon. They let me down. So my friend gave me a phone number. I called this guy and he goes, yep, I can send you 100 grand, but it's 15% of 5 points. I'm like, sure, just send me 95 grand, whatever you got. But man, I got the money in an hour, literally. I mean, it was insane. So there's always a place for private money in the market. But I would really encourage you guys, if you want to build long-term wealth, focus on raising capital. Now, here's one of my other philosophies. This is really focused over the last 2-3 years. If it doesn't have the potential of making millions of dollars per year, and I can't do it with minimal involvement, I just don't do it. You've got to set a standard for yourself, whatever that standard is. In fact, in the early days, I would track my productivity per hour. And I could point out 10 years ago where I was making $1,000 an hour in real estate, 10 years ago. And what I did was, that really sharpened my thinking. If this activity didn't make $1,000 an hour, I didn't do it. And that's why I scaled up quickly, because I hired people to do everything from running errands to just processing paperwork very early on. There's a lot of activities in your business that just don't make money. In fact, my good friend Tim Bratz puts two check marks. So he focuses, he gets a list of what he does in a day, he puts whether it makes money or not, so he puts a money or no money, I think is the way he does it, then he puts a happy face or a sad face. So if he's not happy and he doesn't make money, I just do the first one, whether it makes money or not, because I'm more robotic. I'll just do it even if I don't like it. If it makes money, I'm in. And so I just went down the list of stuff that made money and stuff that didn't. You'll be shocked. What's left at the end of that list, the stuff that doesn't make money, that's what your first assistant does. It's not rocket science, by the way. If you want to create a job description, write out everything you do in your business, write out, put the money, no money sign, and you'll see very quickly what your first assistant's going to be doing. Kind of awkward, though, if you're saying, do my laundry. I mean, it can get awkward. And I had those over the years where I'd ask my assistant, like I had this one assistant that hated dogs. I was like, yeah, just bring my dog to the groomer. Found out after, like, she'd quit about 6 months later that she hated dogs. She was, like, deathly afraid. She was allergic to, and I'm just having her take the dog to the groomer every week. So anyway, you know, lesson learned. Just listen to your people. Treat them right. You want them to stay with you. Let's talk about processes. The documentation is the key. Where I see most people go wrong starting out their business, they don't start at the right foundation. They're not saving stuff. They're not archiving it correctly. Even stuff like emails. I mean, something simple. Every email in my organization has the address and the subject line. Why? If I want to search something 2 years later, 10 years later, I just put in the address and I find all the emails related to that. We're very, very strict on that. And here's the key. The key is to develop processes, implement them. This is where a lot of people stop. They just create processes, they implement. Just new process every week, it's a new process. What's the problem with that? If you don't create a feedback loop to see whether it's working or not, a check and a balance, you can have your new systems and processes can get derailed in a week, in a day even. So it's really important to develop, implement, and figure out how to use the owner, how does that feedback look come back to you if it's not working out quite right. And then the maintenance part of this, which is cool, once you've created that feedback loop, part of that feedback loop is stuff that's not working. Now it goes into optimization, automation, and so work, it's much easier though. It's much easier to monitor and optimize and automate than it is to develop. This is probably the hardest thing, developing and implementation. And you definitely have to put your thinking cap on to figure out creative ways to get feedback loops on stuff that you've set up. But it's so dangerous in your organization to set up a new process, implement it, and never check back in it again. I would just really encourage you guys, this is why having a strong office manager and just really strong people in your organization to provide checks and balances. So let's talk about today's market. We're gonna go, you guys ready to go fast? Ready to do this? Okay, warning signs of a bad market. Just take pictures if you want, because we're gonna be blown through this quick. So you wanna check primary indicators in local markets. Super low supply fuels rapid appreciation. What's happening right now? There's not a lot of retail deals. And that's what's fueling this rapid price appreciation. Landlords selling an entire portfolio is a really good indicator that there's something coming that's not great. Cracks in the armor, DOM, days on market climbing. Sold price versus list price. That ratio is declining, which means stuff's listed here actually sells down here. Supply starts rising. These are all really good indicators right here. These three things will definitely give you a really good clue what's going on in your market, especially when you run a 12-month trend, 2-year trend, 5-year trend. You'll see what's happening. It's cool. Like in Tampa, there was 18 months of supply at the bottom of the market. There's about a month now. It's insane. So, state of the market according to Forbes. I pulled a recent article because even what Forbes is saying today was different than what I was saying a few months ago. This year has been promising for home buyers. The unending rise in home prices started to slow. Mortgage rates dipped to unexpected lows. First-time home buyers can expect less competition than last year, but still very much a seller's market. The seller's market will most likely continue. It's a good time to jump on the home buying bandwagon. This is a problem with generalized articles like this. It's just not really telling you the whole story. And furthermore, some of their predictions, millennials will drive the market. I tend to agree with that. The year of the first-time home buyer, maybe their first and last home after crashes. The millennials hitting their prime home buying years, and those numbers are only going to grow. So they're looking at demographics and drawing conclusions about the real estate market. Here's the problem. If you just take one indicator and you hang your hat on that, that's a great way to go out of business. We need to be smart investors where we look at all of the information and we make really good decisions after looking at all the information. So you'll never hear me make these super generalized statements that are just not true for all markets. Let's look at some of my predictions. Most primary markets in Florida have peaked. Affordability has declined year after year and will continue. The combination of investors and purchasing will slow down. Affordability and excess supply due to foreclosure will be a fuel to the market decline. So that's my opinion. So like it, love it, hate it, disagree with it. I got more experience than most of you guys in the market. This is the one time I'm going to flex. Say, I think I'm pretty much right on point with this. In Florida, cyclical market, just like California, just like Arizona, just like Nevada, very similar trends. History tends to repeat itself. We're in an overinflated situation. If I'm selling a house in a C-minus neighborhood for 150, 160, 170,000 to a glorified renter that barely has 3% to put down, in fact, in some cases, I'm putting down the 3%, it's just a fuel for disaster. Now, you couple that with investors saying, you know what, there's no more upside, we're gonna stop buying. You've got a lot of markets here, Jacksonville, do we know what the stats? What's the number of investor purchases as relate? I would say it's probably 40%, I would argue. It'd be fun to check that number if someone wants to fact check me before the end. But I would argue 30-40% of the purchases here in Jacksonville are investor purchases. If investors stop buying, supply and demand dictates all the things being the same, prices go down. So just keep your eyes open. I'm not saying don't flip. I'm just saying be very careful, be very strategic, shorten your market risk, easy flips, get in, get out, get them on the market, price them right, sell them quick. Don't be like the person in musical chairs. When the music stops, you have no chair. So, what now? I would say the primary goal is to be on the right side of the trade, like we talked about earlier. Look at controlling versus owning. A couple different ways you can do that. Lease options is a good way. In fact, one of my mentors at the bottom of the market, great strategy for land, he bought a bunch of vacant land, tied it up for $100 or $200. He ended up unloading every one of those parcels for between $10,000 and $20,000. It was insane. Made millions of dollars over lease options on land that sellers didn't even want. So you can control real estate without owning it. More wholesaling, less rehabbing, if you want to take risk off the table. Stricter underwriting, what do I mean by that? If you've got a range of comps, you take the lowest comp, the highest rehab estimate. That's two simple ways if you want to be conservative. If it still passes a smell test where you make money after a high rehab budget and a low resale price, if you've tried to kill the deal and it still works, buy it. You want to pay attention to local days on market, list price versus sold price, and supply. Rehab easy and affordable houses only. That's the stuff that's moving right now in most markets. Now, obviously, there's niche markets that are different. Most primary markets, the stuff that's moving, quick rule of thumb, 200, 250 and under, that's the stuff that's moving. And don't hold rentals with short-term balloons. Why? Because when the crap hits the fan, lenders don't want to lend. Now you have no exit. Now you're hitting a balloon. And you hand back your nicely rehabbed house with a stabilized tenant to your lender. That's not a place we want to be. So, just want to say thank you for listening to me, and I'll open up for questions and answers, I guess. All right.
Everybody, who was here when Alex Sofakis talked? Two of the smartest people I've met in real estate, completely different opinion on market, what's going to happen. I'm right in between. I have no idea. I'll admit it. I have no idea.
He's the ultimate politician.
I think at the same time is the market does depict like something a lot of people are missing. Like every market isn't made for the same strategy. And I think that's something you touched on really hard. That every market's not made. There's times when buying rentals was really smart. There's times when it's not. So a lot of people, especially when they first start, they get very opinionated on, I want to be a landlord. Great strategy. There's times to do it. There's times not to do it. Mm-hmm. And like you said, be on the right side of it. But let's get this. We don't have very much time, so let's get a little bit of Q&A. Anybody have any questions for Lee?
All right. So if somebody had a question here, they had a two-part question. The first part was, how can I find somebody to be an assistant who is flexible enough and understands the hours that are involved in this business, and also what should I expect to pay them? And the second part of the question was, what type of access do you give your employees to your checkbook, your credit cards, etc.? What sorts of tools do you give them to manage your business?
That's a great question. So anyone who has accessed, well, you've asked lots of questions, so let me know if I don't answer some of them. So I'll try to work my way backwards to the best of my remembrance on this. Anyone who's got access to money, we run background checks on everybody. So that's just what we do corporately. And if you're handling money, there's any kind of fraud or checkbook or fraudulent checks, you're not hired. But I would just recommend all of us here either have had no business and have started a business, or we're at a point that we are right in that hiring phase. With today's world we live in, just do a background check. The fact that you don't have to think about it anymore, just do it. Make sure you use a reputable PI. I like to use a reputable PI versus an automated service. A lot of people that have bad backgrounds know how to circumvent those more click, 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 and get your background report. So I actually use a private investigator, and I even do a deeper search for people that are working in my accounting department, because that's the person that's most likely to try to rip you off. Or if you've got a project manager that's assigning contracts for big dollars and getting kickbacks, that's the two areas where you've just got to really keep your ear to the ground. But I would just say, setting a rule like running a background, that way you don't have to think about it. You just treat everybody the same. So that would be one thing I would say to you. Setting the correct expectations is super important. You can't hire someone and then say, hey, I need you to go drive to Tampa, and you didn't even say that in the interview. That's a great way to lose a good person. Make sure when you give that job interview, or actually, in fact, when you put out the job description, put an accurate description. Say it's a wild ride here at XYZ, you know, real estate investment. We have a lot of funds, work hard, play hard. That's probably more descriptive of my company. You know, but we have a lot of fun. We're all crushing it. We're all making money. It's a good environment. It's a good culture. But, you know, some days you might get in your car and go here. Other days you might be in the office. And that's set those expectations. As far as price points, I would say the Tampa market's a little bit more robust, as a tighter job market than Jacksonville, from what I can see. You really want to be, and in fact, we're hiring an executive assistant. We got nothing in the 35 to 40 range, so we're having to go more 45 to 50 for an executive assistant to get a rock star. And I will say that that's changed. You know, when you look at record unemployment, people go, oh, that's cool, that's not relevant. Well, it is relevant. It means it's a tight job market, which means if you want to hire the best, you got to pay a premium. That's just reality. That's where unemployment numbers kick right in for something like you. But it's going to be hard to find a real rock star. What I mean by a rock star is someone who can handle something start to finish. Someone who is an intelligent decision maker when I'm not there. And you don't get that. If you're paying 10, 12 bucks an hour, you're just not going to get that kind of decision making, and you're not going to get that level of a person. You know, even simple things like in the interview, everyone says they're organized, right? Well, show me your calendar. I don't have a calendar. Well, get out. You know, you're not organized. I mean, it's just, you can ask really simple, straightforward questions like, well, do you have a to-do list? No, I don't. Well, then you're not organized. If you don't have a calendar, you don't have a to-do list. Like, you're just wasting both of our time. I don't want an assistant that doesn't have a to-do list already. I want someone that loves being organized and just like does backflips about making lists and getting stuff done and crossing stuff. That's my person. That's who I want to hire. I don't want to hire someone like, hey, did you do your task list? Hey, did you check your calendar? I mean, imagine running around after your assistant. So ask those questions up front, set correct expectations, put out an accurate job description, pay well, and don't settle. That's what I would say to you.
Question here, the attendee asked Lee if he's doing rehab and flip out of his market. He says yes, and then he followed up by asking if he's doing it in other markets and how he does that.
Really easy, because it's paint and carpet, literally. So we just have to hire painters and carpet people and appliance people. And it's just really simple stuff. That's why I do newer build homes. I mean, my last one I did in North Carolina, just went on the market today for $550. We put $26,000 in that house. It was just a cosmetic job.
Who would be your boots on the ground in that scenario?
That's a great question. The strategy that we engage is we go through several BPO agents to find one that's intelligent and has a Rolodex of people they already deal with. And our deal with them is, if you view us as a good BPO, we'll give you the listing. Not only give you the listing, but part of your job is to give us good contractors to get this house rehabbed so you can list it. So we actually use a realtor who's been in the market for many years, has a good Rolodex of really good contractors. So we're not picking people out of a phone book. Well, actually, don't use phone books anymore. What's that? Yes, and what's nice about that, you don't want a contractor 2,000 miles away sending you their progress picks. So we send in either the realtor or a third-party person that we hire to just take pictures for us. Because the biggest trap you can fall into, whether it's living in Jacksonville or rehab in Tampa, or living in Jacksonville and rehabbing in Wyoming, doesn't make a difference. Once it's out of area, you need to get independent eyes to verify contractors' work. So that's where it's a little bit different. If it's your own team that's local, it's either you or someone on your local team, so you're getting that feedback, not relying on the contractor. You have to apply that same mentality, and that's probably your biggest risk factor. Plus, big permitted jobs, I can't handle those out of state, so I don't do them. I let the other guys. I only buy new stuff. That's how we've mitigated that risk.
Who else? So my question comes down to employees, right?
Yes.
So how do you know, or how do you manage like pay raises and stuff like that? Like, for example, right, you have an employee that you're paying, for example, $40,000 a year, and if they like, I could pay them $50,000-$60,000 because of the value that they bring or whatever, right? Because now they've been with me for some time or whatever. So how do I bump up their pay with, I don't know if that, my question is making sense, but like, how do I give them a pay raise without them waiting until they quit to bump them up all the way up to 50 or, you know what I mean?
That's part of being a good owner and being a good manager, that you're in tune with your people. And I've mentioned this to Francis, I'm not sure where Francis is, but Francis, my business partner in the educational space. And I mentioned that one of the things I do every morning is I walk the hallways and I talk to everybody. Because I want to have daily contact and at least see what's going on with people. You can look someone dead in the eyes and see exactly that there's a problem. So I try to preempt that. I also have a great feedback loop from my managers and really my entire team. I want to know if someone's struggling or unhappy, because I take the philosophy that it's got to be good for you, it's got to be good for me. It's got to be a two-way relationship. So I try to cut that stuff off. I think if you're down to the point where you're trading more dollars for quitting, it's probably a failed exercise. Ultimately, we put everybody on a yearly review, and you should be paying them right where they're not antsy 2 weeks later. Now, if you start someone off at a low salary, that's okay, but you should set the expectation. We're going to do a trial period here. In 90 days, if you crush it, you don't even have to ask. I'm going to give you X pay raise. But I just try to be really upfront to try to preempt this stuff. I try not to get to the point where you're trying to meet an employee on the bridge or a team member and say, well, if I give you X amount of more dollars, will you work a little bit more? The show's typically over at that point. So the key is to keep your eyes and ears open and make sure that you're attentive to your team and make sure you're paying people fairly. If you go into this thing where you don't view employees as the donkey you're trying to beat until like the donkey collapses, and you view them as people you care about and family and people you want on your team for a long, long time, you're going to start off with a different mentality on how you treat them. And what you will find, especially with the generation that I'm hiring lately, money is not the most important thing. It's like buying houses from sellers. The reason we buy stuff below market value is because money is not the most important thing. People want a great place to work, and I want to provide a great place to work. That's a core principle of all of my businesses. I want it to be fun. I want it to be enjoyable. I do want people to work hard, but I want to be focused on substance rather than form. If you get the result, I'm totally fine with how you get there. I try to be very flexible with that stuff. But it's more than just the money question. It's really down to the environment you've created, because you're competing now in a tight job market against everybody else. If you're just a crappy employer, you could be paying the best money, you're still going to lose great people, because that's not the only thing that drives people in their job.
Awesome. One more question, last one. Obi was barking over here, so.
Well, Haley, you talked about processes and then feedback loops.
Yes.
I'm very guilty of that. Like, start something and put it on autopilot, and the next thing I know, somebody's...
Autopilot.
Yeah, somebody's doing something that I said offhandedly 6 months ago, and they're still doing it. Like, how do you document the processes in an efficient way, and then how do you have that feedback? How do you?
I'll give you a short answer, which is going to cover most of this. Reporting. Reporting is the key. Either you or your manager has to have reports, and what you want your report to do at the most amount of time is a week, or in some cases a month. A lot of the reports are even daily. And what you want to see from the report is this person doing the job, and are they doing it right? If you've created the right report, it should be glaringly obvious. So let's just take it in very simple terms. I'm going to dumb it down to third grade language here. If it's not filled out, they didn't even do it, right? So now they didn't even pass the first test. Just wasn't done. You can say, Mr. or Mrs., why is nothing done? I mean, clearly you're not doing the job. Now, the second part of a great report is you look and you see if it's not done right. So for instance, if you said, let's just say all properties need to be scoped in 7 days, okay? So that would be a fairly typical example for our construction department. If I have a report that shows property not yet in construction and it's day 27, there's a problem, right? So what we have to do as owners is we got to set a range that's normal, and that way we're not looking at every single report and every single item. But what we want to do is create reports that tell us that the work is done, and if it falls outside the range, then it's a problem that comes on our table. That's the most general answer, but you know, with this crowd here and the time we got, that's the best answer. Reporting is the key for that feedback loop, and you got to put time into your reports to tell you the work's being done and the work's being done correctly. That's the best answer I can give you.
Awesome, Lee. Hey, guys, we're going to wrap it up. I want to thank Lee for coming out tonight.
Yeah, man.
And all you guys for showing up. It's a big thing. We'll be right back.